So, Mr. Shaw, you have been making music for more than 60 years, and yet, so far as I know, these are the first performances you've ever prepared of Antonín Dvořák's Stabat Mater. How come? What took you so long to get around to this great work?
I can think of a couple of reasons, Martin. The first is ignorance, part of which could be chance. Though one would have thought that George Sell might have guided me toward this piece when I was with the Cleveland Orchestra in Cleveland, and he being Czech, he having also realized and orchestrated Dvořák's Slavonic dances. I simply never heard the work. I've never heard of a live performance, nor even had I heard of a live performance until I began studying the work 4 or 5 years ago. The other series of answers to that question is that there were other priorities in Atlanta. First was building an orchestra and expanding a season, and the second was building a repertoire, which had to be largely orchestral, and so I was, in my years that I first became associated with the orchestra in Atlanta, I was doing, in terms of choral performance, I was doing the works which I had done before, and not expanding that repertoire as quickly as my orchestral repertoire was expanding. I wonder, for me now, having done 3 live performances and participated in 3 recording sessions with the thing, why it hasn't been more popular and there haven't been more possibilities of performance in the United States. I think it would be interesting to see how frequently it's done by season by major orchestras, and also what might be the performing record of orchestras as old as Chicago or New York Philharmonic or Boston or Cincinnati, because I think one would find that it had been rarely performed in this century. And I really can't explain it, because to me it's a work of extraordinary vitality and almost mystical communication.
Well, we'll get back to the Dvořák Stabat Mater in just a moment, but of course you have, Mr. Shaw, performed and recorded other wonderful settings of this ancient poem before, those by Karl Szymanowski and Giuseppe Verdi and Francis Poulenc, among others. What is it about this text, or what is it about the skill of the composers who have set this text that has drawn you to the Stabat Mater?
What's drawn me to the Stabat Mater of Verdi and Szymanowski and Poulenc is because it attracted them so vigorously and so deeply, because I think somehow that by Verdi in the 4 sacred pieces is really essence of Verdi, and I feel the same way about Szymanowski and Poulenc, that they are representative pieces at their highest compositional creativity. I think what has also drawn composers to it is its emotional and somewhat mystical intensity. It is almost a sort of a religious enslavement and mysticism that comes out of this poem. So in spite of it being repetitious and not as great as some of the other liturgical texts which are not biblical, I think it does have a certain overwhelming emotional quality about it.
Well, let's get back now to Dvořák's setting of the Stabat Mater. For those of us who know Dvořák, the orchestral composer, the writer of the great symphonies, the Slavonic dances, the cello concerto, or even Dvořák, the chamber composer, introduce us briefly to Dvořák, the choral writer.
Well, he's a very accomplished choral writer indeed. Among his compositions are 25 or 30 unaccompanied choruses, and I found that there were 110 to 120 songs written in various languages, 10 of which, of course, were the biblical songs, which have had a great popularity even within our culture. Though they're written in Czech originally, they have English biblical texts, and anyone who's raised in any sort of a Protestant denominational service familiarity has heard several of them many times if he was a regular churchgoer. The demands of the solo quartet are rather unique, it seems to me, because they call for voices of operatic respectability and size and opulence, but with extraordinary ensemble skills. And so I think it's very, very difficult to find solo voices who have the vocal authority and actually even size to sing against the heavy Dvořák orchestration, but also have the ability to become part of a quartet of vocal soloists in almost as superbly organized a manner as a fine string quartet. The choral parts are also call for a certain rather special expertise. They're not difficult in terms of notes, but they're difficult in terms of enunciative clarity and also in terms of quick changes of drama in both color and dynamics. So far as the orchestral playing is concerned, it calls for very beautiful solo woodwind playing and for rather exceptionally disciplined string unison utterances. It has the qualities that we expect from the Slavonic dances and from such pieces as the symphonies and the cello concerto.
So for those of us who know strictly the orchestral Dvorak, there are places where we're bound to say, aha,
yeah,
that
yeah,
sounds
I think
like
Dvorak. You might almost occasionally recognize a series of five or six notes that, oh, I think I've heard those before. And it's possible that even in that instance they come from unhesitatingly from his background in folk music. One of the things that has amused me a little bit about in the harmonic study is that it's almost true that he used chords in this piece which would be available on an accordion with those buttons for the seventh chords that make it possible to go from key to key. So it's not an adventuresome harmonic language, but it is an extraordinarily demanding emotional commitment, it seems to me.
Now, at the heart of this ancient poem, Stabat Mater, is the symbol of Mary at the foot of the cross, mourning the death of her son, Jesus. And Dvorak himself knew grief. He had buried three children before he finished his setting of the Stabat Mater in 1880. How much of his being acquainted with grief do we hear in this music?
It's not only that he lost three children, but he lost three children within the first 4 to 5 years of his married life. And it was just, I have heard it said that it's almost impossible to recover from losing a child. The first three children must be a terrifying and terrible thing. If the piece is available to any criticism at all, it is that it may wander a little bit, as though this measure somehow invites meditative qualities in the next, which somehow invites a further measure, which somehow invites another measure. And one does hear, I think, a lingering. And it's possible that had he had time or had the piece not as been as successful as it was at its first performance in England and other places, that he might have been able to do some pruning here and there. But his wandering is precious and a part of the somehow the musical communication of mystery. I can't remember in my last 10 to 20 or 30 years a piece which so completely stunned people and took people by surprise in the orchestra and the chorus, and in the audience too, listening, that it communicates on a level which, for which words simply are not appropriate or sufficient. People are very, very deeply moved by it, the performers and the singers and the quartet and the audience, and without somehow expecting it or knowing why, because the piece doesn't posture. It doesn't make grand statements until at the very end of the piece with a sort of a brilliant toccata, amen. There is no, the rest of the piece is substantially meditative.
Can you tell us why, Mr. Shaw, briefly, why are people so overwhelmed by this work at first hearing?
I'm not sure I can do it at all, and certainly not briefly. I don't know, but all I know is that it happened. And I think because it's rather simple, that is, in harmonic complexity. It's simple. It's simple music. It probably has roots in folk music, and folk music probably has roots in the basic human emotions, which are tragic and occasionally happy. And it's one of the proofs that music is necessary and important, is that you can't explain it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the piece meanders, and it meanders along for about 82 minutes, making it perhaps the longest setting of the Stabat Mater. What sort of toll, if any, does that extract on you or your performers?
Members of a chorus and members of a professional orchestra are used to working for 80 or 90 minutes without before an intermission, and in this instance, you work for maybe 85 minutes and you can go home. Since there are 10 movements, there are also 9 moments of pause. But it's also fortuitously planned by Dvorak that the first movement is the longest in the piece and is substantially 3 times as long as the last movement. And so the piece is has its not its intellectual weight, but it has its weight in terms of time at the beginning and gradually shortens itself as it goes farther and farther along.
Is there a particular moment over the course of Dvorak's Stabat Mater that you find yourself looking forward to each time you do it?
One of the things that moves me most is the first entrance of the chorus in the first movement. One has 3 to 4 minutes of orchestral introduction, which substantially have introduced all of the musical material that the choir and the quartet are going to use in the next 14 to 15 minutes. But the choir comes in on Stabat, on the text Stabat Mater, the mother standing at the foot of the cross. The chorus comes in a stumbling fashion. The words are interrupted by rests, even rests in the middle with syllabic rests, so that it seems to be somewhat incoherent and speechless at the beginning. It comes in only with the tenor voices in unison, which suggests to anybody with imagination the solitariness of the mother standing there, rather than the full choir singing, however quietly they might sing. And then it stumbles again because it has 3 beginnings. The sopranos then come in alone, and the tenors then begin another thing. And so it does not only stumble in terms of its first entry, textual entry, it stumbles in terms of musical periods of 8 to 12 measures each, and it tries to begin 2 to 3 times after the orchestra has already begun with 3 minutes of beginning. So it's a very, very beautiful and touching symbology, at least to me. The 2 favorite elements so far as choruses are concerned, and one of which would had to be repeated, were numbers 3 and 5. One was Ea Mater, Fons Amoris, which is number 3, and Tui Vulnerati, Nati Vulnerati, number 5. But the beginning is for me is a very precious moment.
The Stabat Mater was a huge success for Dvorak in London when it was premiered. Yet, as you yourself said, you haven't had a lot of opportunities to hear it in this country. Do you think this is a piece that's unjustly neglected, or are there, in fact, certain performing problems that get in the way of its being performed?
There are not that many serious performing problems, and it is unjustly, I think, neglected. I don't know anything about its current European history. Certainly it's been neglected in the United States so far as my information is concerned. The difficulties are, as I think I've indicated before, one, finding 4 solo voices that are capable of being heard in a very thick and massive orchestra, and also finding voices which have the expertise of working together. One of the problems, chorally, is that you need a chorus big enough to be heard against the massive orchestral forces, but you need it small enough to get details of enunciation and a change of emotional color. Because the minute you get a chorus of 300 to 400 voices, you begin to wash out its sort of personality or its textual clarity simply by the mass of sound, let alone its discipline. And you need woodwind soloists of really wonderful emotional quality. So it's not easy to do, but it's one would fall into it naturally, and at least in our performances, didn't require in any sense extra rehearsal, even though it's a longer work than one usually associates with a concert program. And the orchestra fell into it very naturally and read it very, very handsomely the first time. Of course, it's a beautiful and wonderful orchestra now.
Mr. Shaw, as we approach another Thanksgiving for you, I'm wondering what thanks are you offering up this year?
Well, it's a reasonably personal question, isn't it? And one wonders how to answer it. I should be grateful for life and breath and health at this time in my life, and also the chance to make such music as the Stabat Mater with this orchestra and chorus and this particular quartet of soloists. But also I've had a wonderful season with the National Orchestra in Washington and Boston and St. Louis and Minnesota. So that is certainly the first element of gratitude. Second, that the family is intact as it is, and the younger members of the family are doing as well as they are in their own chosen fields. And I think the other thing that should be said is that there are wonderful young choral musicians, and that the choral field has been elevated through scholarship and through performance disciplines to as important a position in the hierarchy of musical forms and institutions as other elements are, symphonic music and opera and so on, are in our country. And there are wonderful young musicians like Craig Jessup and Gerald Otley, who head the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. There's a wonderful woman, Elvira Voth, who is now engaged in a program for the arts in prison reforms, and which begins with choral music and developing choruses in prisons. And if, without being sentimental, you could be thankful for people like Benjamin Rowe and Martin Goldsmith and public radio. So that, does that answer your question?
Very generously, yeah. Yes, sir. I'm wondering what sort of music you like to hear performed at this time of year. I think of such wonderful spirituals that you have arranged with Alice Parker as Amazing Grace, as just quintessential for an American Thanksgiving.
They certainly, a piece like that is wonderfully eloquent at this particular time of year and handsomely arranged by Alice. It so happens that I've been playing catch-up all my life, and what I have time for hearing at Thanksgiving is that which I have to rehearse and perform on the day after Thanksgiving. And so there's no doubt about those pieces being appropriate, and also Rejoice in the Lamb of Benjamin Britten. In text and music, that seemed to me a wonderful borderline schizophrenic text is one of the touching pieces in the poems in the English language, and handsomely realized by Britten, who never really chose a bad text. But
Talk to us a little bit about Rejoice in the Lamb. I mean, at the heart of that wonderful piece by the poetry by Christopher Smart, I mean, he offers thanks for his cat and for the flowers and for music.
Yeah.
And that does seem like such a wonderful, innocent, and yet heartfelt piece.
Well, I mean, you've already talked it and you've said it. It's exactly true, and it rides the borderline, I suppose, of early Hebrew prophecy, in which the mystic is so close to ecstasy that it seems no longer to translate into the daily existence. And Christopher Smart's experience as in and out of asylums in London in their terrifying years is just a wonderfully, wonderfully touching thing of a man substantially whose mental capacities were presumed destroyed by society, but advanced ideas and in a form which touches human beings centuries and centuries later.
Well, finally, Mr. Shaw, we were talking a bit earlier about you were taking up the challenge of performing and recording Dvorak's Stabat Mater in your ninth decade. Are there any other major works, choral or otherwise, that you've got your sights on?
Martin, I never have had the opportunity, and to record the St. Matthew Passion. I recorded the St. John Passion and I guess the B minor Mass three times, possibly. It's a work of such importance and preparations that it has to be scheduled years in advance. And in the past four decades, the scholarship has changed almost daily about Baroque performance and performance practices, with modern instruments versus ancient instruments and so on. And one has hesitated year by year to seek a chance to an opportunity to record it. And I began to wonder whether, in my own mind, whether it was one of those pieces that is unrecordable simply almost because it shouldn't be recorded. It's a living experience. And one of the exhortations of the prophets was that thou shalt make no graven images or grooven images, maybe and so it's not that the piece needs a live audience, because an audience can sometimes get in the way, I suppose, of a of a St. Matthew Passion, but it only somehow exists when it is done in its place, and somehow like a lifetime exists only in its own borders of living, and it is so indeed special that it's almost a sin to record it. I don't mean the sin in the Christian sense, but it defies recording and it defies it in such a way that it makes it almost wrong to do it.
Well, Mr. Shaw, I must say every time about this year when I start adding up the things for which I am thankful, before too long I come to the fact that a man named Robert Shaw still walks the earth. Thank you very much for your time and a great happiness during this holiday season to you.
Thank you, sir, very much.